I see we have some people standing. If you have there's any vacancy in your pew, could you please raise your hand so that people in the back can, if you want to sit, there are some still spots available. A few years ago, I remember the cover of Time magazine that read, "What if there is no hell? What if there is no hell?" It was an article published by Time magazine about a book published in that year, 2011, if I'm not mistaken, by a evangelical preacher, Rob Bell, and the title of the book was Love Wins, about heaven and hell and the fate of every person that ever lived. What is the argument this pastor made in that book? The argument is that God's love is so great. He gave his son out of love for us. How will he not now give us everything else? Therefore, in the end, everyone will be saved. Hell will be empty. Even the fallen angels, even Satan, in the end will change, will convert. Now, this book stirred up a huge, furious controversy, especially among evangelicals. Why? Because obviously this does not reflect the biblical understanding that yes, God did indeed love us to the end, but he has not taken away from us the possibility, the real possibility of saying no to his love. In today's readings, we have a chance to hear very clearly this message of love, of incredible compassion the Lord has for us. We hear it in the three readings, the second book of Chronicles. Keep in mind that this is the last book of the Jewish Bible. And actually, it's the last chapter, the last, very last words of the Hebrew Bible. How does it end? It's the story of the Babylonian exile. People were unfaithful, adding unfaithfulness to unfaithfulness, abomination to abomination. The Lord tried in his compassion to change his people by sending his messengers, the prophets, but people scoffed at them, ridiculed them, mocked them. And we are told that God's anger was out of control. Well, let me tell you about God's anger. It's not an emotion. God doesn't change. God is love. And so even his anger, what the Bible calls anger, it's nothing but tough love. Love with a passion. God's love was so much that seeing that his people was on a path of self-destruction allowed the enemies to conquer them and to bring them into exile. But God did not abandon them. And 70 years later, raised up Cyrus, king of Persia, to set his people free, to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. In the end, God's love, God's mercy, God's compassion was stronger than the punishment. In the second reading, the letter to the Ephesians, we hear the same message. God is rich in mercy. When we were dead, or somewhere else Paul writes, when we were God's enemies, he did not abandon us. Out of grace, he saved us. Not out of our merits, not because of what we did or we could do. No, out of grace. For pure gift, God saved us. And in the gospel, we have one of the most beautiful lines of the whole New Testament, maybe the most beautiful line, John 3:16. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. God so loved us. So we have no doubt. God has loved us, has given us everything. But still, the gospel adds that those who prefer darkness refuse light. Those who do not believe will be condemned. So in the end, there is a chance to be left out of God's love and salvation. C.S. Lewis said it eloquently when he said that the gates of hell are locked from within, not from the outside. Those who are in locked themselves in. Why? Because they did not accept this incredible love of God. God loved us so much that he gave us his son. I wanted to tell you a story about this line, how to understand it. But instead of me telling you the story, I would like to allow Matthew Kelly, who wrote this story in the introduction, the prologue of his book, Rediscovering Catholicism. It's a fable, if you wish, but it helps us understand what it means when Jesus says that God loved us so much that he gave his son for us.
Imagine this. You're driving home from work next Monday after a long day. You tune in your radio, and you hear a little blurb about a village in India where four people have suddenly died from a flu that's never been seen before. You don't think too much about it, but coming home from church the following Sunday, you hear another spot on the radio, only now they say it's not four people dead, but 30,000 people dead in the Black Hills of India. By Monday morning when you get up, it's the lead story, only now they say it's not just India, but Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Northern Africa, and everybody's wondering, how are we ever going to contain this thing? The president has made some comment that he and his family are praying and hoping that all will go well over there. But everybody is wondering, how are we ever going to contain this thing? And that's when the president of France makes an announcement that shocks all of Europe. He's closing the French borders. Nobody in and nobody out. And that's why that night you're watching a little bit of CNN before you go to bed. Your jaw hits your chest as a weeping woman is translated into English from a French news program. There's a man lying in hospital in Paris, dying of the mystery flu. It's come to Europe. Britain closes its borders, but it's too late. Panic strikes. As best they can tell, after you contract the disease, you have 1 week of unbelievable symptoms, and then you just die. Nobody knows what it is. Nobody knows how to stop it from spreading, and nobody knows how to cure it. Britain's closed its borders, but it breaks out in Southampton, Liverpool, and London. And on Tuesday morning, the President of the United States makes the following announcement. Due to a national security risk, all flights to and from America have been canceled. If you have loved ones overseas, I'm sorry. They cannot come home until we find a cure for this thing. Within 4 days, America is plunged into an unbelievable fear. Preachers on television are saying, it's the scourge of God. People are wondering, well, what if it comes to this country? And on Tuesday night, you're at church for a meeting when somebody comes running in from the parking lot screaming, turn on a radio. And while everyone listens to a small radio, the announcement is made. The two women are lying in a hospital in New York City, dying of the mystery flu. It's come to America. Within hours, the disease seems to envelop the country. People are working around the clock trying to find an antidote, but nothing is working, and the disease breaks out in California, Oregon, Florida, Massachusetts. It's as though it's just sweeping in from the borders. And then all of a sudden the news comes out. The code has been broken. A cure can be found. A vaccine can be made. But it's going to take the blood of somebody who hasn't been infected. And so sure enough, each and every single one of us is asked to do just one thing. Go to your nearest hospital and have your blood tested. By the time you and I get down to the hospital, it's late Friday night. And they've got long lines of people. And they've got doctors and nurses coming out and taking blood and putting labels on it. And they take your blood and they say, wait here in the parking lot. And you stand around in the parking lot with thousands of people, with your family, with your friends, scared, waiting, wondering, wondering what on earth is going on here, wondering how, in this modern day and age, did we ever allow it to come to this? And then all of a sudden, a young man comes racing out of the hospital. He's screaming a name and waving a clipboard. You don't hear his name. He screams the name again. You don't hear him again. But then your son tugs at your jacket and says, "That's me. That's my name they're calling." Before you know it, they've grabbed your son. They're racing him into the hospital. You run after them. You say, "Wait a minute. Hold on. Where are you going? What are you doing? That's my son." They say, "It's okay. We think he's got the right blood type. We just need to check one more time to make sure he doesn't have the disease." 5 minutes later, out come the doctors and nurses, crying, hugging, laughing. It's the first time you've seen anybody laugh in almost a week. And an old doctor walks over to you and your spouse and he says, "Thank you. Your son's blood, it's perfect. We can use it to make a vaccine and put an end to this thing once and for all." As that news begins to spread across the parking lot, people begin to scream and pray and laugh and cry. But then the old gray-haired doctor pulls you and your spouse aside for another minute. He says to you, "We didn't realize that the donor would be a child. We didn't realize the donor would be a child. We're going to need you to sign a consent form." Well, that seems simple enough. So you take the pen, you begin to sign the form. But as you do, you realize that the box for the number of pints of blood to be taken is empty. So you stop signing and you look up at the old doctor and you say, "How many pints?" And that is when the old doctor's smile fades. He looks away from you. He says, "We didn't realize it would be a child. We weren't ready for that." You say to him again, "How many pints?" The old doctor says, "We're going to need it all." "What do you mean you're going to need it all?" You said, "He's my only son." Doctor grabs you by the shoulders and he shakes you and he looks you in the eye and he says, "We are talking about the whole world here. Do you understand that? The whole world." You say to him, "But I mean, can't you give him a transfusion?" Doctor says, "If we had clean blood, we would, but we don't. Please, will you sign the form? We need to hurry." What would you do? What would you do? Will you sign the form because you realize it's the only thing to do? And then the old doctor says to you, "Would you like to have a moment with your son before we get started? Could you walk back into that hospital room where your son sits there saying, 'Mommy, Daddy, what's going on?' Could you tell your son you love him? And then when the doctors and nurses come back and say, 'I'm sorry, you'll have to leave now. We've got to get started. People all over the world are dying. Could you leave?' Just turn around and walk out while your son sits there saying, 'Mommy, Daddy, what's going on? Where are you going? Why are you leaving? Why have you abandoned me?' And then next week, next Sunday, when they hold a ceremony to honor your son and his phenomenal contributions, some people don't bother to come because they got better things to do. A whole bunch of people come with a pretentious smile. They pretend to care, but they're really more interested in the whole social aspect of it all. And another bunch of people sit around and say, 'This is pretty boring.' What would you want to say to them? Wouldn't you want to stand up and say, 'Excuse me, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but the incredible life you have, my son, he died so you could have that life.'" Maybe that's what God wants to say.